If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Good morning. President Trump went to Pennsylvania to tell voters he's bringing down prices. Most voters blame him for the economy's troubles, and Trump didn't announce any new policies to turn things around. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, the West Contra Costa teacher strike is over. A deal reached this morning. I'm Brian Wine.
A community of highly trained Afghan soldiers who fought against the Taliban for the CIA now feel abandoned by the CIA. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Four have died by suicide. Another is a suspect in the D.C. National Guard shooting. Also, Hamas tells NPR it is willing to give up its weapons for up to 10 years, but only if there are negotiations with Israel about a Palestinian state. It's Wednesday, December 10th. On this day in 1869, the governor of the Wyoming Territory signed the first U.S. law explicitly granting women the right to vote. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Another federal judge has ruled that more material from the investigations linked to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein can be released. These documents are secret grand jury transcripts from his sex trafficking case in 2019. Congress recently passed a law ordering the Justice Department to disclose its Epstein case materials. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. She's been in hiding in Venezuela, threatened with arrest. Her daughter, Ana Corina Sosa Machado, accepted the prize today in Oslo.
I am here on behalf of my mother, Maria Corina Machado, who has united millions of Venezuelans in an extraordinary effort that you, our hosts, have honored with a Nobel Peace Prize.
Nobel officials say Maria Corina Machado is expected to come to Oslo soon. The Trump administration has stepped up efforts to curb illegal immigration in the U.S., but extremism experts say the administration is using language that comes directly from the white nationalist movement. NPR's Odette Youssef reports.
After an Afghan national was arrested in the shooting of two National Guard members in the nation's capital, Trump called for reverse migration. The State Department and the Department of Homeland Security have also used the term remigration in social media and planning documents. Heidi Beirich of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism says European white nationalists use remigration to refer to the ethnic cleansing of non-white people.
When I think about this, I cannot believe that a federal government in the United States would use terms that come from white supremacists. There's always been some sort of barrier to that being mainstreamed.
The White House, State Department, and DHS rejected or did not acknowledge questions about the term's link to an extremist movement. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
The Environmental Protection Agency is now downplaying the role humans have in climate change. NPR's Jeff Brady reports instead, the EPA website highlights natural processes that increase greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and heat up the planet.
Until recently, an EPA website labeled Causes of Climate Change relayed the scientific consensus that humans burning fossil fuels have made the planet hotter. Now, that same site focuses on things like volcanic activity and changes in the Earth's rotation. EPA Press Secretary Bridget Hirsch says in a statement that the Trump EPA is focused on protecting human health and the environment, quote, not left-wing political agendas. As such, this agency no longer takes marching orders from the climate cult, unquote. Trump has called climate change a hoax. The EPA says the old web pages are still available to the public via archives. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up more than 80 points. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. The West Contra Costa Unified School District has reached a tentative agreement with its teachers to end a strike that started late last week, affecting tens of thousands of students. The two sides say they reached a deal early this morning. The teachers' union says the agreement includes raises totaling 8% over 2 years, additional wages for special education teachers, hiring bonuses, and stronger health care benefits. The union is calling today an optional classroom prep day for its teachers and says regular classes should return to normal tomorrow. Some pro-Palestinian students at UC Berkeley plan to hold a one-day hunger strike today to support a lecturer who's been suspended after he spent class time expressing his political views on the war in Gaza. Perrin Cao went on a 38-day hunger strike earlier this fall, which he disclosed to his computer science students, but he says he didn't tell them why he was doing it. Nevertheless, he says he was told that created a hostile environment for students and led to his suspension.
It was something that I think is totally protected by the First Amendment because I'm doing it in my own capacity outside of the classroom, and I continued all of my teaching duties throughout the entire 38 days of hunger striking.
Cal's union has filed a grievance. The university told KQED in a statement they can't comment on personnel matters. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University, providing education to prepare students for an AI-driven economy. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org and by the listeners of KQED. Traffic in San Jose now with Mel Baker at 8:06.
280 northbound before Saratoga Avenue, a two-vehicle injury crash now on the shoulder, but emergency crews there may be blocking a lane. Traffic is nearly at a stop back to Race Street. In San Francisco, 101 southbound at Cesar Chavez, traffic is backed up to the 10180 interchange by a multi-vehicle crash blocking the left lane. Further south, 101 southbound in Burlingame between just before Broadway, we have a box truck and car crash. Traffic is slow back to the SFO exit. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Ahead with Brian Watt on KQED News at 8:22, the Oakland Unified School District is facing budget troubles again. The district's board is now expected to vote on major cuts, with a plan calling for potential school closures and mergers. Money in Oakland schools on KQED News ahead for you. Ahead, another day of Thule fog and stratus for the North and East Bay, according to the National Weather Service, trying to get some morning sunshine through the dense fog. Some fog hanging around through late morning into the early afternoon parts of the Bay Area. Otherwise, plan on sunshine and hazy skies later today. Not so hot, highs in the mid-40s to the low 60s. San Francisco's high today only 52, 51 for the high in Livermore today, barely 50 in Concord, Oakland up to 57. The time now is 8:07.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. President Trump told a rally crowd in Pennsylvania Tuesday night that he has no higher priority than making America affordable again.
They caused the high prices, and we're bringing them down. It's a simple message. If I had one message tonight, you know, this is being covered like all over the world. This is crazy because I haven't made a speech in a little while. You know, when you win, you say, oh, I can now rest.
He talked about a whole lot of other things, too.
And NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here to help us decipher what the president had to say. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So did the president have some new message or some policy prescriptions for Americans who are upset about the high cost of living?
The banners on the stage said lower prices, bigger paychecks. And that was the message in essence. Trump insists prices are coming down and brought up on the stage a handful of people who stand to benefit from the tax cuts he signed into law earlier this year. There were no new policies and not a lot of new material. But if you go to see the Village People, you'd be disappointed not to hear YMCA. So Trump spent much of this 90-minute speech going through the greatest hits, talking about how members of his cabinet are straight out of central casting, denigrating Somali immigrants, weaving all over the place, joking about how it would be boring if he stuck to the teleprompter, and occasionally making it back to the economy.
Lower prices, bigger paychecks. We're getting inflation. We're crushing it. And you're getting much higher wages. I mean, the only thing that it's really going up big, it's called the stock market and your 401ks. It's going up.
Okay, that might be true. Stock values are up, but a lot of people, actually more than a third of Americans, don't have money in the stock market.
Yeah, and as our friends at Marketplace always say, the stock market is not the economy. A recent Fox News poll found 3/4 of voters view the economy negatively, and 2-1, they blame Trump for the current economy rather than former President Biden. The economy used to be Trump's strength, but at the moment, it's a major weakness, and Democrats are certainly making the most of it. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro posted on social media that Trump spent his speech, quote, telling Pennsylvanians not to believe what they can see with their own two eyes, the skyrocketing cost of living and rising prices at the grocery store.
So how is the president squaring the sour mood that voters are in with his pitch that he has ushered in a golden age for this country?
He's not really. Take this from an interview he did this week with Politico's Dasha Burns.
I wonder what grade you would give.
A+.
A plus.
Yeah, A++++.
You know, Trump typically has strong instincts for appealing to his base, but he does risk looking out of touch here.
And how does he respond when confronted with those concerns?
Last night, yet again, he mocked the preoccupation with affordability.
They have a new word. You know, they always have a hoax. The new word is affordability.
He says that he inherited a mess. In other words, don't blame me, blame the former guy. And he says things are already cheaper. In particular, he talks a lot about gas prices. According to Gas Buddy, prices are down about 8 cents on average a gallon from a year ago. But that's not really enough savings to make up for higher grocery prices and utility bills and health care costs.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
For more on President Trump's efforts to both downplay affordability concerns and blame the Biden administration for the cost of living, we're joined by political consultant and pollster Frank Luntz to break down what's behind the rhetoric. Good morning, Frank, and thanks for being back on the program.
Thanks for having me. And I do want to focus on what Tamara just said. Lower prices, bigger paychecks. The issue for him, the challenge, is that he does look out of touch if he's saying that affordability is, in his words, a hoax.
Yeah.
The American people do believe that they're paying more, and the core elements, and you can call this F squared, H squared, food and fuel, housing and health care. The public believes that, and now it's almost half the public struggles paycheck to paycheck. And when they see the president saying that prices are coming down, it may be true. I'm not going to argue over the details, but I will argue over the perceptions. And when you talk about affordability, it is all perception. The greatest danger is if you tell people that happy days are here again and it's 1929.
You know, you mentioned that he keeps saying affordability is just a Democratic hoax. Why is this such a difficult issue for Trump to own?
Because he owned it against Joe Biden just a year ago. This is the reason why he was able to defeat President Biden, is because the public thought that the former president didn't do enough to bring prices down. And the Trump campaign hammered him day after day, effectively saying you're paying too much and you're getting too little.
How will this impact Republicans heading into next year's midterms?
Well, here's the thing. There's actually time to fix this.
Mm.
That people are not making decisions over who they're going to vote for in November of 2026, in December of 2025. And the key date for me is Labor Day. Around Labor Day, the public makes a decision. Has this administration, has the people in charge been effective and efficient and accountable? Do they have a track record of meaningful, measurable success? That decision will not happen for another 9 months. But what's critical for the president, if I were advising him, which I don't, but if I were advising him, I would lean into this because this is what the public believes. And you can't tell them something that they don't feel at the pump, that they don't feel at the cash register. And particularly the next issue, insurance, health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Are prices going up? If I were a Republican strategist, which I used to be, I'd be telling them that that is the issue that could cost you the majority.
Well, it seems like so far Trump has taken no accountability for any issues around for affordability, either blaming the Biden administration or saying it's completely made up.
Well, again, I don't want to focus on policy. I focus on the language because that's my profession. But it is a legitimate attack to say that inflation was much higher, was much more significant under Joe Biden, and that the country continued to spend because of COVID months or even years after it should have. That said, it's now a year since the election, and the public does expect this administration to take charge. At a certain point, they will not accept the blame game. He may be responsible, but you, President Trump, you promised to fix it. Are you doing it?
And how is that showing up in the polls? I mean, how is this messaging resonating with Americans?
Well, I don't think it's necessary. And this is the good news for the Republicans, is that the Democrats aren't liked either. And this is the bad news for America, that both political parties are failing. Both political parties aren't offering the results and the success that they have promised. And so the public is starting to look at this and say, to heck with all of you. You've made promises you cannot keep. I don't trust you anymore. But because the Republicans are in charge, they're the ones to pay the price. They're the ones that have to deliver. So in the end, the blame game may work today in December of 2025. It will not work November of 2026.
Do you see affordability right now as a winning message for the Democrats? I mean, we saw that play big in the New York City mayor election.
Absolutely, because it's a day-to-day issue. It's not really ideological. People are genuinely suffering. And when you're living, and I don't use the word blue collar, I don't talk about middle class, I talk about paycheck to paycheck, because that's how people live. And that paycheck to paycheck voter is annoyed. Democrats are coming out to the polls. Republicans are staying home. And if that continues, that spells bad news for the Republicans. But I end this interview as I began. It is not too late. The election is still 10 months away. Things can be very different November than they are right now.
Frank Luntz is a political consultant and pollster. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
It's an honor. Thank you.
The number of high school seniors or their parents filling out the federal form for access to college financial aid, the FAFSA, is way up this fall. That's despite indications that many Americans are souring on the importance of higher education. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
Seeing so many students fill out the financial aid form matters because it's often a critical step in the college process, and it's correlated with more students enrolling in college next year. Sean Sobush is a high school senior in Florida. He'd heard from a friend's older sister that filling out the form called the FAFSA took her several hours.
I did go into it expecting it to take the whole afternoon.
But this fall, when he opened up his laptop at his local Starbucks and navigated to the online form, it only took about 15 minutes to complete.
So it was really simple, and I mean, it definitely was a welcoming surprise.
Sobush is among the more than a million high school seniors who have already filled out the FAFSA, up about 6% compared to 2023.
It's good to have good news about the FAFSA.
Bill DeBon is with the National College Attainment Network, an organization that helps track FAFSA completion.
Nationally, we're aiming for all-time highs in FAFSA completion this year.
There are two main reasons the numbers are so high this year. The form is much simpler, thanks to recent federal legislation. And in addition to being fast and easy, the form was also made available way earlier this year, on September 24th. In the 2 years prior, the form didn't open up until sometime in December.
We have had a strong start. We should continue that momentum, right?
DeBon says schools shouldn't get too cocky. To reach an all-time high FAFSA completion, at least a million more students still need to fill out the form by summer, at a time when confidence in higher ed generally is really low. This distinction rings true for Sobush in Florida.
I feel like a lot of students are worried that it will not be worth it in the future.
But yet, it sounds like everybody is still applying.
Yeah,
is that right?
It is kind of contradictory. But I think if they can attend for a lower cost, that it is worth the risk.
And in order to do that, they first have to fill out the FAFSA. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Listening to KQED, listener supported. Thanks for listening at 819, and thank you for your support. I'm Dave Freeman on this Wednesday morning, and ahead for you, it's Brian Watt standing by with the latest KQED news in about 31 minutes. Statewide coverage on the California Report. At 19 after 8, Mel Baker checking in, taking us now out to Vacaville.
80 westbound before Mason Street, this accident involving three vehicles still there, still blocking the three right lanes. Traffic is nearly stopped back to Leisure Town Road. As you approach the Bay Bridge, first of all, there is a box in the right lane just before Treasure Island, but at the backup is before the toll plaza, it's backed up all the way to the maze. 580 westbound is backed up all the way to Highway 24. It remains very slow across the upper deck into San Francisco. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting The Perfect Neighbor, a documentary by Geeta Gandabir. Body cam footage bears witness to a night-knit community navigating one neighbor's relentless harassment and the consequences of Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. Awards eligible. Berkeley representing Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays, a special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org.
Next on the California Report, California used to build condos as an affordable path to home ownership. Now, they're nearly vanished, and a growing group of housing advocates say state laws are partly to blame. I'm Adi Bolaños. We dig into what happened and what it would take to bring condos back on the next California Report.
On Forum at 9, a discussion with leading researchers at the University of California about federal cuts to health research funds. Support for NPR comes from Total Wine and More, where people can find wine, spirits, and beers for holiday gatherings at Total Wine and More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. Heifer International, where people can donate animal gifts to families living in poverty. Whether it's a goat, chicken, or cow, each gift is intended to help families earn a sustainable income. Heifer.org/NPR. And Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. This is a busy, challenging moment for Bay Area public school districts. Early this morning, the West Contra Costa Unified School District reached a tentative contract agreement with its teachers, who have been on strike since last week. Later today, the board for the Oakland Unified School District is set to vote on big budget cuts. How big? $100 million. Or else OUSD risks another county or state takeover. Here to explain all this is Ashley McBride, education equity reporter for the Oakland side. Ashley, hello.
Hi, Brian.
So first off, tell us more about the district's latest plans to slash the budget.
Yeah, so for years, OUSD has had a structural deficit. And over the last few years, they've been able to use one-time dollars to kind of paper over that deficit. But the last of those COVID relief dollars expired last year, so there's really no other option at this point than to make cuts and restructure the district. The plan that the board majority has been pushing for is for the central office, which is the district headquarters, to be consolidated.
Okay, so what kind of expenses are we talking about when you describe the central office of the district?
I think Sandra Aguilera, OUSD's chief academic officer, summed it up pretty well at a meeting a few weeks ago when she said there are very few positions at the central office that directly serve students, but that the role of the central office is to develop the adults who work with students. So things like providing training and professional development for staff. The central office also provides a lot of support to principals in running their schools, the facilities and buildings and grounds divisions, things like that.
Okay. What impact could this all have on classrooms?
So last month when staff presented the central office restructuring plan to the board, it only reached about $21 million. So there will almost certainly be cuts at school sites. People will probably be laid off because staffing costs are the biggest slice of OUSD spending. And so if the board approves the plan, then the real work will begin at each school, figuring out exactly what to cut. So that could mean like sports programs or extracurriculars that are paid for with discretionary funding.
But that still seems like a long way to get to the $100 million. They got a lot to figure out here, right?
Yes. The plan that Superintendent Sadler is presenting amounts to about $102 million. So there were some categories that I haven't mentioned that include a reduction in special education spending, for example. So it'll impact all parts of the district. And this December 10th meeting is crucial because the district has to submit their budget plan to Alameda County by Monday, December 15th. And if the county superintendent feels that the plan is lacking or she has criticisms of it, it could move the district closer to going back into receivership.
And this budget debate is likely serving as a test of sorts for the interim superintendent, Denise Sadler, right? I mean, she took on the role just as the district was leaving state takeover for the first time in years. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the board separated from former Superintendent Kyla Johnson-Trammell earlier this year, and Sadler took over in July. And what's interesting to me right now is that one of the apparent reasons for the separation from Superintendent Johnson-Trammell was over school closures. So school closures and mergers seem to be back on the table, and Superintendent Sadler is essentially recommending them.
Wow, a lot to watch here. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you.
Ashley McBride covers education for the Oakland side. Among the challenges facing people leaving incarceration is housing. One Bay Area nonprofit is trying to meet this need, and it's now expanding into San Francisco. Here's KQED's Azul Dostromekman.
Here's how it works. People leaving incarceration are matched with people like Mimi Vaughn, who have a room to spare.
I was super skeptical. I'm like, I don't know if I want to live with anyone, let alone live with a person who's been formerly incarcerated.
Participants get a stable place to live, rent-free, for 6 months while they get help finding a job and a place of their own. In exchange, the hosts get around $1,500 a month. That tipped the scales for Vaughn. At the time, she was a single mother of two and wanted to put her kids through college.
I was like, okay, if I do this, then my kids will come out with zero student loan debt.
Over the past 3 years, she's gone on to host 19 participants between her two homes in Oakland. She says it's been rewarding.
It's funny because they always say that they learn a lot from me, and I say that I've learned a lot from them.
All right, do that one more time. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Oh, so much better. You could tell I was a teacher.
Recently, dozens of people celebrated the expansion of the Homecoming Project into San Francisco at the city's Public Defender's Office. The effort began in Alameda County in 2018 and has reached Contra Costa and Los Angeles counties as well. Currently, there are 17 hosts participating. Bernadette Butler heads the housing lab at Impact Justice. That's the nonprofit which runs the program.
This is, at the heart, a way to address homelessness.
She cites a grim statistic. People who are formerly incarcerated are nearly 10 times more likely to experience homelessness than the general population. Danielle Harris is with the Public Defender's Office. She says, in the past, the office has worked with the program, but that meant they could only place people with hosts in other counties.
We don't ever, as San Franciscans, want to say we are looking to other counties for services that our folks here in San Francisco need, that our families here in San Francisco need.
Over 200 people have graduated from the Homecoming Project so far, and one of them is Felipe Kelly.
Unfortunately, I pay rent. I pay rent right now, so I'm not a participant anymore, but it was great, though. I had a blast.
He was incarcerated at San Quentin Rehabilitation Center for 6 years. After his release, he was placed in transitional housing in Oakland, but he says he wasn't happy with that living arrangement. Eventually, he moved in with Mimi Vaughn through the Homecoming Project.
To be able to live in a place where you can walk outside your door and you can just breathe the fresh air, you can just look around, you can feel safe and you can feel comfortable, you can feel happy where you're at, means a lot.
The Homecoming Project is now looking for hosts in San Francisco. The organization says no one living in the city has signed up yet. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
And we're staying in San Francisco. Mel has traffic in the city.
where we have a sig alert on 101 southbound at Cesar Chavez. The two left lanes are blocked by a multi-vehicle crash. They're trying to get enough tows in there. People are walking on the roadway. Traffic is stopped back through the Central Freeway interchange to the Octavia on-ramp. Meanwhile, in the Dumbarton Bridge, 84 westbound at the high rise, the center lane is blocked by a landscaping truck. Traffic is backed up to the toll plaza. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and onstage blizzard. Runs now to December 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. You're listening to KQED at 8:30.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Trump administration's under court order to end the National Guard deployment in Los Angeles. A federal judge in California has ruled that President Trump must return control of the troops to the state. Despite objections from Governor Gavin Newsom in June, President Trump put thousands of service members on L.A. streets to protect immigration facilities and forces. The vast majority of the troops have since left, but there are still around 100 in L.A. Trump held a campaign-style event last night at Mount Pocono in a swing congressional district of Pennsylvania. He promoted financial relief announced 2 days ago for farmers who struggled in the U.S. trade wars.
We gave the farmers a little help, $12 billion, and they are so happy. And they all they want is a level playing field, and now it's happening.
Farmers who qualify will receive one-time payments in response to the tariff hikes and a decrease in export demand this year. In the runoff for Miami mayor, Democrat Eileen Higgins defeated Trump-backed Republican rival Emilio Gonzalez. Here's NPR's Josh Snyder.
Former Miami-Dade County Commissioner Eileen Higgins is now the first Democrat to win the Miami mayor's office since 1997. According to a preliminary vote count cited by the Miami Herald, Higgins will take office having won nearly 60% of the vote in the runoff election.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. The Dow is up 220 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The Federal Housing and Urban Development Department is reversing course for now on major changes to a key program aimed at addressing homelessness, a program that has helped thousands of Bay Area families. KQED's housing editor, Aaron Baldessari, explains.
Last month, the Trump administration changed long-standing policies by prioritizing funding for temporary rather than permanent housing and emphasizing mental health and drug abuse treatment, but HUD reversed course this week after two separate federal lawsuits challenged those changes. Ryan Finnegan is a homelessness policy researcher at UC Berkeley and says the unpredictability is hard on people whose housing relies on HUD funding.
For the people who are wondering, am I going to get to keep living in this building? What's going to happen to me?
In the Bay Area, the funding helps pay for housing for about 6,800 households. HUD has said it would issue new guidelines in the coming weeks. I'm Aaron Baldessari, KQED News.
The man accused of fatally stabbing a social worker at San Francisco General Hospital last week missed his arraignment date Tuesday because he's being held for psychiatric care. Wilfredo Tortolero Arrieti was set to be arraigned on a murder charge after the attack last Friday in the hospital's long-term HIV clinic. Deputy Public Defender Sylvia Nguyen will represent him.
He is currently hospitalized due to his mental status. The court has just appointed our office to represent him. I obviously need to have time to review the materials, and even more importantly, I need to have time to meet with him.
The hearing was postponed to next week. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Morning support comes from Oakland's San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Public media thrives when our community does. Keep independent voices strong and turn up the volume at KQED.org/donate. Thank you kindly for your gift. On Morning Edition coming up, the Afghan man accused of attacking two National Guard soldiers last month was a zero-unit fighter. Some of its members have struggled with their mental health since relocating to the U.S. More just ahead. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And by the sustaining members of KQED.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A community of Afghan soldiers who fought against the Taliban for the CIA now feel abandoned by the agency.
One member of that community, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, is accused of shooting two National Guard soldiers last month. NPR spoke to people involved in the Zero units and learned some have struggled with mental health since coming to the U.S. At least four soldiers have died by suicide.
NPR's Brian Mann has our exclusive reporting this morning. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Michelle.
Lakhanwal was part of an Afghan Zero unit. What does that mean?
So these were Afghan special forces fighting against the Taliban. I spoke with Geeta Bakshi. She's a former CIA agent who spent 4 years in Afghanistan, often working with these Zero unit troops.
These guys were the tip of the spear. They were out on the front so that American personnel didn't have to be. They were the ones that were facing the maximum danger on the battlefield.
And their tactics were often brutal. Groups like Human Rights Watch accused them of engaging in torture and illegal killings. Thousands of these Zero Unit soldiers, including Lakhanwal, were evacuated to the U.S. in 2021 after the Taliban took control of Afghanistan.
You have learned that many of these Zero Unit fighters are struggling. Why is that?
NPR reported last week, Michelle, that before the attack in Washington, D.C., Lakhanwal appeared to be experiencing a personal crisis. He's since pleaded not guilty to murder and other crimes. Now people involved in these units tell me that many of Lakhanwal's fellow Zero Unit fighters have felt similar stress and isolation and despair. They describe feeling betrayed and abandoned by the CIA after years of that frontline combat service. They expected to be treated with respect in the U.S., given a chance to start new lives here. Instead, they found themselves tangled in a complicated immigration process, often stuck without permanent asylum or work visas for years. And I spoke about this with one Zero Unit fighter named Daoud.
It's like that feeling of like you did something, but nobody is appreciating. And the promise that was given to you by your employer was a fake promise.
Now, Daoud agreed to speak with NPR if we agreed to only use his first name. He said he fears for the safety of his family still living in Afghanistan under the Taliban. He told me when Zero Unit fighters living in the U.S. reached out to the CIA for help, they often got no response. NPR also reached out to the CIA and the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to ask about all this. Both agencies declined to comment.
You found that some of these Zero Unit fighters grew so frustrated they threatened to harm themselves. What's your sense of how widespread this is?
Yeah, people who've been working with these Afghan soldiers say it's been really widespread. Daoud told me he's scrambled repeatedly to help fellow soldiers who feel hopeless, but he said some didn't make it. And Geeta Bakshi, the former CIA agent, she now leads an aid group for Afghans called FAMIL. She says her organization also started working to prevent suicides as early as 2023.
Individuals from the Zero units, unfortunately, suffer death by self-harm. We raised this issue to the Biden administration, and again, we saw a direct connection to prolonged immigration delays.
And now, again, Michelle, these Zero Unit fighters and their families are facing new fear and uncertainty. President Trump has suggested many of these Zero Unit fighters may not be allowed to stay in the U.S.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Brian, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
And let me mention that if you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. That's 988.
Hamas is ready to lay down its weapons for up to 10 years. That's what senior Hamas officials tell NPR as they gear up to negotiate the next stage of the Gaza ceasefire. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
A 20-minute drive away from the skyscrapers of dazzling downtown Doha is the suburb where Hamas's senior leaders are based.
Okay, so this is a beautiful street of tan buildings, villas, palm trees, decorated walls, and there's a policeman in a car right outside.
Hamas security guards usher us into a parlor room with a Palestinian flag, a Hamas flag, and a photo of the Jerusalem skyline on the wall. We meet senior Hamas negotiator Bassem Naim. He was sitting with Hamas officials in September when Israel tried to kill them.
We were near to end the meeting at 3:45 p.m. We hear the first missile striking the compound. To be honest, we were not expecting such an attack at that moment.
At that moment, Hamas officials were gathered to review a U.S. ceasefire proposal they had received the day before. He and the other Hamas negotiators survived the airstrikes. The strikes hit an office they had been sitting in just a few minutes before. He says they had moved locations as a security precaution. That failed Israeli strike led to a U.S. success, getting the sides to agree to a ceasefire. Today, Hamas has one more Israeli hostage body to hand over, and then comes the next phase of the ceasefire, with Hamas disarming. Naim says Hamas is willing to negotiate over its weapons.
We are ready to lay down these weapons. I mean not to use it for 5, 7, 10 years, as long as we are not attacked. Because the second question is always, okay, Palestinians have to be disarmed. What about the other side?
Naim says Hamas will not disarm unless there are negotiations toward a Palestinian state. We asked the White House and the Israeli government to respond. Neither commented on the details of Hamas's offer, a disarmament limited in time and the demand for talks toward a Palestinian state. A White House official said Gaza will be fully demilitarized according to President Trump's peace plan, and the U.S. expects Hamas to abide by the deal. An Israeli official says Hamas will have no future under the plan. It will be disarmed and Gaza will be demilitarized. We asked the Hamas officials about their decision to launch the attack which killed around 1,200 people on October 7th, 2 years ago, given the tens of thousands of Palestinians killed in Israel's retaliation. Naim said Hamas should not be held responsible for the devastation of Israel's response.
If you are going to ask me about what happened during these 2 years, this has nothing to do with October 7th, because history didn't start on October 7th. And this has not to do with the response of a state if someone decides to commit a genocide. This is not the mistake or the fault of someone who defended himself.
Israel rejects the charge of genocide in Gaza. We asked if Hamas achieved the goals it laid out in its October 7th attack.
Yes, Hamas has achieved some of the goals of Palestinian people. Before October 7th, the Palestinian question was nearly forgotten.
He said the war brought Palestinians back to the top of the world's agenda and turned public opinion against Israel, even in the U.S. Naim called that a strategic win and irreversible. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Doha, Qatar.
This is NPR News.
Time again for KQED traffic, beginning in Marin.
In San Rafael, 101 northbound at North San Pedro Road, a hazard or stall is blocking the right lane. Novato coming south on 101 between Roland Boulevard and North San Pedro Road is just crawling along. Richmond-San Rafael Bridge backup now is only beginning at Castro Street to the Toll Plaza. Mel Baker for KQED.
Our morning traffic support comes from Glime the Jeweler. I'm Dave Freeman with a KQED listener perspective at 8:43 now. Kristen Nelson shares why it's important for parents to support their children.
A few weeks ago, hundreds of high school students, including my own children, walked out of class to protest gun violence. As a parent and as someone who has spent 2 decades working in school-based mental health and administration, that moment became an unexpected lesson. To be honest, I didn't want my kids to join the walkout. After a recent incident on campus, the chaos surrounding it, and my own parental fears, I questioned whether the walkout could be safe, organized, or effective. I encouraged them to consider alternatives, meet with school leaders in the library, attend a school board meeting, request action through formal channels. Those remain important avenues. But watching our students move as one, peacefully, powerfully, and with purpose, I realized how deeply they felt the urgency. The very youth I have spent my career serving became my teachers once again. Their collective action reminded me of something we, as adults, too often forget. Youth Voice is one of our best sources of truth and direction. When they speak in unison, it reflects a reality we haven't been willing or able to confront. Schools are not isolated institutions. They are mirrors. The fear, trauma, and violence in our communities inevitably show up in our classrooms and hallways. Every day, school administrators, teachers, security staff, custodians, and front office workers show up to care for our children, often with limited resources and under extraordinary pressure. Can we improve safety, prevention, and supervision on school campuses? Absolutely, and we should. But we cannot pretend that school staff or even district alone can fix what is fundamentally a community crisis. Where is our collective community response? Where are we showing up? When children take to the streets because adults have failed to protect them, it should shake us awake and then move us to action. Because if young people are the ones stepping forward to protect their future, the very least we can do is show up beside them. With a perspective, I'm Kristen Nelson.
Kristen Nelson is a licensed clinical social worker. Support for Perspectives comes from Leif Cabraser, Hyman & Bernstein, seeking justice for the injured, victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over five decades. Online at lchb.com. Next on Morning Edition, as you may have heard earlier this morning, Miami has elected its first female mayor, the first Democrat in the position in nearly 30 years. More about Miami's mayor-elect coming up on Morning Edition here on KQED News. And at 8:51, more California stories with Mari Bolaños. Followed at 9 by Forum, of course. We hope you'll be a part of the Forum team. Join us with Alexis Madrigal and Mina Kim from 9 to 11 this morning. Partly sunny around the Bay, some areas of North Bay and East Bay fog throughout the morning, mostly sunny, and hazy skies later today, highs in the 40s to the 60s, maybe rain Monday. Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And Yarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the sustaining members of KQED.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Miami has a new mayor-elect and a history-making one at that. When voters there elected the city's first female mayor last night, Eileen Higgins, a former county commissioner. She's also the first Democrat to hold the seat in nearly 30 years. She beat Republican Emilio Gonzalez, who had the support of President